Street Northwest in D.C. Details at WPFWFM.org and FreeDCProject.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
At 89.3 FM, this is member supported WPFW Washington.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAIFM. Good afternoon. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shayunana Show. Today we are going to be listening to this long interview that was conducted between Mary and Francois, who everybody should be listening to, an amazing analyst and a brave one that has been basically shutting down the falsities and putting forward the truth about what's happening in Gaza. And also, like, I love her takedowns of these pundits that seem to be returning to the same talking points given to them by the Israeli lobby. She'll be interviewing Ashish Prashar. And what's significant about Ashish is that, you know, sometimes the truth needs to be triangulated. You know, there's one extreme and another extreme, and you triangulate it. And I'm not talking about NPR analysis, which is not a triangulation, but a dilution of the truth. I'm talking about the where you basically experience, for example, a conservative point of view, and you follow it fully, and then you experience the liberal, so-called liberal point of view, or the left point of view, and you follow it completely. And I'm talking about this in an institutional sense, and then that, you know, the truth lies with neither, but somewhere in the middle, you learn the nuances. That's what happened with Ashish Prashar, because believe it or not, what you're about to hear is somebody that was the former advisor to Tony Blair, who was complicit, of course, in the Gulf War. And Ashish is one of these rare people, one of these amazing people that puts himself fully into the project. And when he sees the lies, he immediately drops out and starts organizing against this. And on the other hand, also remember that Tony Blair's was, you know, who had bloodied his hands in the Gulf War and lied about it. And also, of course, this guy was, and I mean Ashish Prashar, was also a Biden campaigner. And also he saw Biden betray everything within the first 3 months of his term. And now he's actually suing the Biden administration. And he, like me and like others, believe that I don't care if Biden is in retirement, he needs to be dragged to court for the crime of genocide, as per every international court in the world has called for. This has to happen if we are to resume justice in the 21st century. And of course, Anthony Blinken needs to be with him. And anyone that was involved in the lies that they put forward, including bizarre things like repeating that he saw photographs of 40 beheaded babies, which became the cornerstone of the building the propaganda for genocide. So that's the significance. But what's also significant about this segment too, about this interview, is listen out for when he starts talking about the real reason that Mahmoud Khalil, the activist in Colombia, the Palestinian activist who was a refugee in Syria and was a leader in the encampments, which I actually saw last night, last evening, and it was like tears like rain. Believe me, I encourage everybody to go see it either at AFI in Silver Spring or at the Angelica Theater in Virginia. It's incredible. It's an incredible document. Something that's going to go into the time capsule. What's the reason he gives about Mahmoud Khalil's basically kidnapping by ICE and how they took him to Louisiana, thousands of miles away from his pregnant wife, who's about to give birth this month. And he gives it as the real reason, which is something we've been talking about when we talked about Gaza being the litmus test for global justice. It's not just that, but specifically, as Prashar says in this interview, it is because the Palestine is the canary in the coal mine basically the destruction of democracy, the establishment of fascism. And he explains it as this, that if they succeed in bringing this to trial, which they are doing now, and winning, it means that they can open up this kind of deportation to any U.S. citizen. And that would mean millions of people under this fascist regime will be deported and expelled or put into trial to defend themselves after a legal precedent has been established with Mahmoud Khalil. So even if you didn't care about the Palestinian question, and if you truly care about democracy, then you should be fighting for Mahmoud Khalil at this point. So, and lastly, I just wanted to say that what's happening today, and I'm glad universities are now finally resisting the interference by government, but what's happening today at all universities is that critical thinking is being attacked and besieged in every university with and this is by foreign entity, namely Israel, and that's what's at stake today. And we can talk later at a future show about the fight back that's growing right now against this. So let's start with listening to this interview between Maryam Francois and Ashish Prashar.
Where is your fight? You know, I still see too many people in our circle who condemn resistance. 2 years into a Holocaust at this point, not a genocide, a Holocaust. They're burning people alive. If you tolerate this, it will happen to our children. That will happen here. And this is the moment for everyone to act.
Welcome back to the first episode of a brand new season of The Tea, the show where we dive into the stories behind the stories. I'm your host, Miriam Francois. Before we get into this episode, I just want to take a tiny moment to ask you to do one thing for me, and that is to hit that subscribe button now. We're a small independent team, no big networks here, no corporate backing, just a handful of people who care deeply about having honest conversations and shining a light on what often goes unseen or unheard. So if our work does resonate with you too, then subscribe now on YouTube and join us on Patreon, link in our bio. Today, I'm joined by Ashish Prashar, a political strategist and former advisor to Tony Blair, who's worked on political campaigns for the likes of former US presidents Barack Obama and Joe Biden. But after years working from within the system, Ashish has taken the bold move to work outside of it, shifting his focus towards human rights and Palestinian liberation. He's now part of a new legal effort to hold the former US president Joe Biden, a man he once campaigned for, as well as members of his cabinet, accountable for their role in the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Ashish, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, you once campaigned for a man who is probably not the most popular president to go down in history, US president, former US president Joe Biden. Can you tell me what it was about his vision, his platform, that initially drew you in?
Honestly, I mean, as someone who'd worked for the Democrats in the United States, 2020 seemed like a different time to now. You know, we had Trump in office at that time. He was mishandling COVID. It was a disaster. Biden's team, who, you know, I know a guy who was ended up being his chief of staff, was reaching out to people who've worked formerly in senior Democrat roles and was looking for people to get on the team, because Biden promised he'd like be the guy who got rid of Trump and would be in for one and would only serve one term. And we all know he ended up serving only one term, but, you know, as you know, he tried to run again because the arrogance of office does that to people. But, you know, at the time it was, the world was on fire again. It was weirdly on fire. We were in a pandemic, by the way, still ongoing in some way. But also, you know, we had BLM, we had people marching in the streets. We had a really revolutionary environment in the United States. And Biden weirdly campaigned also on reforming and that very fascist police force that now that was being used and deployed in the way it is today, but it was at the time killing black kids, still is, by the way, on the streets of America. And he was the Democrat pick at the time in a what seemed like a fixed primary, for lack of a better term at the point. But he seemed like an alternative to what could have been doom with Trump at that point, right? Because the pandemic added that layer of uncertainty that, will he even give us vaccines?
Well, and so we're talking about an era where it still felt like there was a choice, between the candidates. And so I'm very interested to hear from you about the perception among many people today that actually wasn't possible, for example, to continue voting for the Democrats, given the position they'd taken on Gaza. And that whilst there would have been an era not that long ago where most people would have said, well, just to keep Trump out, we will vote Biden regardless of anything, that there's something about where we're at now that things have changed, right? That maybe the illusion of choice within our political systems has started to erode to the extent that I'm not sure that whether it's a real or an illusionary sense of choice has been maintained for many members of the public, whether in the US or in the UK. So I'm just, did that factor into your shift?
Well, so foreign policy, someone who's a Brit, also knowing American foreign policy and working on foreign policy, American foreign policy has never really changed it from president to president. But domestically, selfishly, we were like fighting what we thought was the leader who's going to take, you know, just effectively destroy the country, right? That's how it was being pitched, right? Someone who had no morals, someone who was going to take our rights away and everything else.
Go against the Constitution. So
you said he would be a permanent president.
Massive tariffs that are likely to tank your economy. I mean,
all the things he's doing today, right? But also, like, the problem with all of that was the Democrats won the election. Biden won the election. By the way, the people won that election. To your point, I think you mentioned people didn't want to vote for Joe Biden. So a lot of us wanted any Democrat president to beat him at that point, right? So we wanted someone to stop his crazy, stop his oppression. You already saw elements of it really early with the BLM stuff, where he was like walking to a church and asked his troops to fire gas canisters directly in the crowds that were protesting. You know, you saw elements of how far it could go.
Yeah.
And Biden just was the alternative. The American public won that. The black activists won that election. The indigenous activists won that election because they had to get Trump out.
Yeah.
Because they, at that point, the alternative, the Trump term being the second term, seemed like doom. I'd say the biggest mistake, and I want to just point this out, is kind of wish he won. And the reason I wish he won is he could have accelerated almost this imperial downfall of the United States, but also domestically. There hasn't been a more revolutionary moment in the United States than 2020. And that
2020?
Yeah, because people, white moms were on the front lines of those BLM marches. White people were putting their bodies on the line. White people were being shot at by the police to protect their black neighbors at that point. The police were on the back foot. The institutions were on the back foot. And the reality is, the reason they wanted us back at work is to stop caring about each other. What Biden's win allowed to happen was take the wind out of real revolution.
It neutered the revolutionary impetus that many people were observing.
Yes.
And that many people who are critical of the current political makeup of our societies would say is what consistently happens to any movement that seeks radical change 100%. In the face of a system that's systemically broken, right? And that is to afford these kind of piecemeal concessions that allow people to feel like some level of victory was achieved, but actually what progress was actually undertaken.
And a black activist told me he allowed white people to tap out.
That's white people to tap out.
So we elected the good guy.
Yeah.
We did our job. Take it from here.
So what was your turning point with Biden? Because obviously you're there, you're campaigning for this person. You obviously believe that he can offer an alternative that's necessary. You're obviously very politically invested, but there's a turning point for you.
Right. So for me, I am also impacted by the justice system here in the United Kingdom. I was incarcerated as a kid here. I believe in abolition. It's been in my DNA for a long time.
Yeah.
Even trying to work in with the system, I've tried to change things. Ironically, you're going to laugh. The biggest justice reform bill passed in the United States was by Donald Trump, of all people, not a Democrat. In fact, Bill Clinton and Biden and Obama have locked up more black and brown kids than even their Republican counterparts.
Which speaks to the point we were just making a second ago, right? Which is these small concessions that ultimately don't actually disrupt the fundamental inequalities.
And Biden went back on all his promises. Like, there's a manifesto which you can still download from their 2020 campaign, because, you know, they don't delete things, I guess. And it made promises of massive reforms on the police, a defunding, frankly, from the federal lens of it, a look at sentencing, getting rid of the death penalty permanently, making sure people who are in weed were all re-released, enforcing federal laws onto states to do that. All these things that, while not perfect, are a huge step forward in freeing people who should not be incarcerated, in changing the power of the police force. And it was very telling within 3 months that was not going to happen.
Yes.
Like, he dismantled all those promises. He actually increased funding for the police in his first 6 months.
So can I just roll back a second here, Ashish, because this wasn't your first foray into official politics, right? You'd worked for Tony Blair prior to that. You'd worked for Boris Johnson's campaign here in London, the former mayor of London, and also former prime minister. Surely this can't have been your first delusion, you know, shattering of your illusions about the promises politicians make and what they actually undertake. Mm-hmm. But something was different this time, because you've not stayed within the formal political processes. So what was different this time?
I mean, when I stepped out of the other roles, they were for real moral reasons. And going back to different people in those worlds was for a specific reason. Mm-hmm. For example, like in OA, I resigned from the Conservatives because, you know, I wrote a whole piece in the New Statesman, which you can still get today, saying, hey, these guys are racist and prejudiced. And if you elect them in 2010, you're doomed. And we've seen what that led to. And Blair, you know, like, the reality was, when offered an opportunity to work on the Middle East peace process, part of me thought, and this is something that even maybe people like George Galloway, who I've had conversations with about this, have told, you know, part of me thought he negotiated Good Friday with Clinton and everyone else.
Yes. So for those who aren't familiar with the Good Friday Agreement, it's, you know, the seminal peace agreement between the Irish resistance in the form of, you know, politically represented by Sinn Féin, but militarily represented by the IRA, and the British, who continued to occupy Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm. And part of me thought that he wanted to undo the Iraq legacy. Like, you know, we all know how politicians care about their legacy, how people are going to remember them, you know, what is going to be said about them in 50 years. They are like narcissists to their core.
Sure.
And part of me thought, taking advantage of that narcissism, is that maybe he wants to actually create a settlement that would be good for everyone.
Yes.
Where he could undo what Iraq did.
So you had hopes that you could play to this man's egos in a way to advance, you know, peace in the region.
Yes.
Which, you know, to be fair, you wouldn't, I'm sure, be the first person to hope you could lean into that. And I know I've heard this said about people close to Trump, that there are efforts to, you know, figure out what buttons his ego enjoys.
100%. And look, I was in you know, a lot younger. And at that time, I was like, there's something here. He also wanted to openly talk to Hamas.
Yes.
You know, it's also not a secret. He's written about it in The Guardian, how we should talk to terrorists, and quote unquote, what we perceive as terrorists.
So you go into Middle East peace process with Tony Blair. Obviously, backdrop of this is the Iraq War, which was obviously a complete disaster. Mm-hmm. We were lied to. Millions of Iraqis lost their lives. Iraq continues to be in disarray till this day, you know, reeling from the consequences of that illegal invasion. But you're thinking to yourself, there may be an opportunity here. So you go into this opportunity, and what do you sort of unravel?
For me, it was being in the West Bank. You know, for me, it was you know, a lot of the work's done remotely. You know, London, New York, wherever we're meeting people of influence in this. And a couple of incidents happened in the West Bank, and I was like, okay, this is not, you know, this is not ever going to be solved by any of our institutions.
Give me one of the starkest of those.
One of them was our Israeli escort telling us that this road was sanitized. And what, we haven't heard language like that since Nazis, right? So, and frankly, apartheid South Africa, meaning that when we were being driven down this road, telling us that it's been sanitized because Palestinians can't come on it, and showing us examples of it, right? So you have a street where there's Israeli houses and they can come out on the street, and there are Palestinian houses on the street, but their doors have been welded shut. So they can't literally come out on that street. They find another way out of their own home to somewhere else.
Yes.
Sanitized.
Right.
Think about that, the language.
And what was the reaction of the team around you?
Most people kept their mouths quiet, and I was a bit shocked that anyone would do that. And also, someone who's experienced as a young age, like, I know what that is, you know, oppression, like being in a prison in the United Kingdom.
Yes.
At 17. So, like, you know, I know that. I know that.
So let's roll back for people who don't know your personal story then, just briefly. So you're incarcerated at 17. Tell us just briefly a little bit about that
story. Yeah, I was incarcerated for theft. You know, I was a stupid kid who was in a group of friends who stole some stuff from Harvey Nichols.
Yes.
Yeah, and, you know, being brown, we weren't given a slap on the wrist. We were actually sentenced to a year in prison in Felton, which is, the Americans watching, like Rikers, which is a really violent thing. And anyone watching in the UK knows that it's where kids get hung.
It's a tough prison.
It's a really tough prison.
Yeah. And I was, this was your first offence?
First offence.
And it was your only offence?
Only offence.
And you took a year?
We were sentenced to a year. And I was out, luckily, within 4 months because, and this is where the funny thing about symmetry in life is, that because my grandparents and my family fought to get me out because they thought the sentence was egregious, my grandparents and my aunt wrote to Jack Straw, who ended up, you know, and...
Former Home Secretary, Jack Straw.
Former Home Secretary, to have me released early, and also let me take my A-levels in prison, which was at that time not normal. They only got up to GCSEs at Feltham the year 2000, 2001, and I was allowed to do that. And
just then, meaning for people who aren't aware, that means that students at this prison could not pursue their education past the age of 14.
16, past, like, effectively GCSEs is 16, and then A-levels 18.
18, so, okay, yeah. So 16, they'd be cut off. They wouldn't be able to pursue education.
No education. And I think that's changed since, but back then that was an anomaly.
But that was still in place until 2000.
And, you know, my grandparents changed my life, right? So they got me out early. They raised me. I owe them the world, and that. But I never forgot that feeling.
Yes.
Right, I was assaulted. I've been held up by guards on a wall and attacked, and like waiting for. And they're looking for a response, right? Because they know if you respond, it's like what Palestinians go through every day. Like if you respond, you get more time. Right, so you have to like keep your calm, keep cool, and all that stuff. And I know what that environment's like. And the second incident in Palestine was exactly that. So we were at a checkpoint, and I literally watched a Israeli occupation soldier take his gun and back the head of a child, a 14-year-old, and beat him in front of diplomats. And no one did nothing. No one said nothing. And even some of us who filed a report, that report didn't go anywhere.
Right.
No one at the UN, which owns the envoy's office, did anything about it.
Yes.
It's probably one of multiple reports that I'm sure have been filed over decades about their abuses, and that's why I resigned. I was like, that's it. We're
so
not going
to return from this trip to the occupied West Bank, and you resign from your position on the as a Middle East advisor.
Yeah.
And just to be clear, what would you say that you learned about the system working within it that continues to inform how you operate today?
The system can be tweaked, but it can't be changed. It needs to be blown up and start again, for lack of a better term, because the reality is that, especially in foreign policy, the West has got its Western policy and it's like extractionist. It's you know, I think this is the reason people hate Trump. The reason Western leaders hate Trump is he's open in his prejudice and racism and direct of, this is what we want.
Mm.
And it removes all masks. You know, right. When he says we want resources, he's talking about them. He's talking about the UK, France. Yeah. He's talking about when they go and back something, what are we going to get out of it? That's literally how all of them think.
Of course.
The reason they're frightened of Trump is he just tells the rest of the world what all Western leaders and politicians and institutions think. And what I learned in the Middle East was that we are going to hold up the Israeli regime and hopefully slowly disappear the Palestinians. So, in my couple of years of work there, that was very true. The projects we worked to develop Palestinians, the economy and everything was small. The Israeli investment was huge. You know, you could see that. The peace, anytime we had conversations with the PA and the Israeli leadership, you knew which side, what statements were going to be published and whatever. And you could see it happening in real time. And, you know, I knew resigning would be the end of any future foreign office or diplomatic career, but it was the right thing to do. And if you've experienced any form of oppression, it shouldn't take you that, but if you've experienced it firsthand, it'd be immoral to sit there and carry on this charade.
So how did you make sense of what you were observing, which is these regular, and I'd say until recently, because as you say, I think with Trump, there is a sort of unwillingness to even kind of play to the charade of, no, of course we respect human rights and international law and blah, blah, blah. Mm. Trump's just like, yeah, we've never cared about it. And it's sort of, I think that's where a lot of us are struggling with this cognitive dissonance, which is like, we always knew that, you know, America had a complete disregard for international law, but at least on the face of it, they were pretending to want to uphold it, pretending that they had to pay lip service. And when that disappears, I think it leaves many of us completely disorientated as to, you know, what is it, this new kind of era that we're moving into? And of course, we can come back to that because some of what we're moving into is plain and visible in 100%. Terms of the decisions that Trump is making. But I just want to ask you before that about something you said there, which was, you know, you observed that, you know, there was this charade of like, we're going to discuss peace or, you know, to try and figure out peace. But then in reality, a profound imbalance in the interactions between the two. How did you make sense of that in the context? So you're going there on what is perceived to be a peace mission, but then on the ground, you witness something very different.
Yeah.
What were you actually doing? Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
You were sent purportedly there about peace, but from what you're saying, that wasn't. So what were you there for?
I think we're always sent for a PR opportunity, right? So I think...
But beyond that, who cares about PR that shows, you know, the Americans or the British being engaged in a peace process?
The Americans and British care about that PR. The Israelis care about that PR.
Okay, but why? Why do they care?
Because they want to show that the people who are not willing for peace are the Palestinians, especially the Israelis. They want to show that they're not, they're the ones who don't want peace. They're the ones, they often bring up that how Palestinians have had like 13 opportunities or whatever opportunities to sign a peace thing. Well, can I ask British people or Americans, if someone walked in, stole your land and then said to you, you'll have 20% of that land or whatever it is, would you agree to those terms? No, I don't think anyone would agree to those terms.
Right.
There is every right for those Palestinians to walk away from those agreements, but they would use these negotiations, they would use opportunities or envoys' offices set up to discuss future terms, future potential states or a settlement between the two to say that Israel's all aboard on this train. The Americans are doing everything they can. You know, the British are doing everything they can to be peacemakers and power brokers in the world. It's soft power too, right? It's our brand to the world. We care about how we did care, sorry, I should say, about how we are perceived to the world.
Yes.
We did try to do this more recently with Ukraine, right? We were like going to save Ukrainians. We mobilized actually the world on a lie, frankly, about this. So we mobilized literally the whole world, countries that would never get involved in this, sanctioned Russia. People in the Global South did. They turned their backs on them and expelled their ambassador. We do this all because we do care about how we're perceived. We do care about the American story. We care about the British story. And we're seen as the good guys. The
so
mask fall off.
We did care, you said.
With the Israeli occupation's recent genocide and continued genocide, I still think the West did pretend to care. like at least Anthony Blinken and Joe Biden famously saying, we're trying to negotiate a ceasefire every week, because they know the majority of the public still watch CNN. And they know the majority of the public still take their news from the BBC. Mm. The majority of the public will still believe their line on this, that they're fighting for this, and the reluctant side is the other side. You often see this in, like, who's bringing down ceasefires. They always say, well, Hamas fired the first shot of this thing. Well, yeah. No, that's never found to be true in the end. And by the time it's untrue, it's too late. But they do care about their brand to their own people and how they're perceived to the rest of the world to a degree.
Mm.
The mask slips off, frankly, during this with Biden, because the lies were just too hard to hide. Like, Israel and America and Britain have always relied on is complete control of mainstream media to get their message out. Our mobile phones changed that.
Mm-hmm.
TikTok changed it. Instagram changed it. Facebook, whatever platform people started to see images on,
yeah,
have changed it. People saw what happened on October 7th. It's changed it.
Yeah.
They saw that the stuff that we were, that people like Piers Morgan were saying on TV wasn't true. They were seeing for their own eyes that we'd been sold a lie, and they couldn't counteract that. And the reason people go, Israel and America with all their money couldn't handle like the effectively other side story, is because they're so used to complete control. They didn't realize that the young in our countries were going to watch dead bodies on TikTok.
Yeah.
They didn't realize that Instagram was going to show people that Israel commit war crimes, and that the Israelis themselves were posting these war crimes. Please. And they had no sense of control. So at the beginning, they thought they were winning this message because, and they were still seen as the good guys because they didn't realize where people were consuming this. And it was almost too late at that point. And then the mask dropped because it became too late. And they were just like, well, whatever. Like the American administration, Blinken didn't even hide it. Blinken was like, yes, we knew starvation was happening in March 2024. But there's a report. He said he didn't care. He even said, well, a group of Palestinian leaders in the United States met with Anthony Blinken. And he said, if we have to care for Palestinians, we will starve the world.
So here's the thing. So we see a shift from the 2000 era to now, where clearly the current U.S. administration and its lackeys, and I say that in the sense that we're speaking here today from London, where there's still this perception that that America is our great ally. I think that there's a, you know, if they haven't observed the slaps they've been taking, I don't know how many more slap downs they need to recognize that no ally of ours would treat us specifically when it comes to things like trade agreements, which is kind of a very simple level at which to negotiate, surely with our oldest ally, is reflective of a different era that we're in right now. American isolationism is in full force, and they don't give a flying about us here in England or in Britain or in Europe. And the quicker we wake up to that, I think, the better. But obviously, there's still this perception that, America is, just slightly off tilt, but is going to kind of recalibrate. And so I just want to ask you about that in view of what we've been seeing in this shift. So we're now seeing, Trump's actions since he's come to power, dismantling the Department of Education, challenging constitutional rights, deportations, the tariffs. It feels like the facade of American democracy itself is unraveling.
Yeah.
And with that, of course, much of the charade around the legitimacy of the international order, which is upheld in many ways by America and the West and their purported commitment to that international framework. Now they no longer seek to uphold it. You know, the defunding of UNRWA and in general, even strikes on UN staff in Palestine suggests that there's an unwillingness to even pay lip service to that old order. So what is your reading of this? You know, I know some people talk about this as sort of indicative of the fall of empire. And of course, theorists have written about the rise and fall of empires throughout history. Ibn Khaldun, has civilizational theories about kind of, for every great civilization that rises, it always comes down. Yeah. What goes up must come down.
Yeah.
Are we in the must come down curb of American decline? Or do we think this is as I think many people are hoping, a momentary deviation or blip?
It's not a momentary deviation. This is America and being honest about this is America being honest about America. Like, it's actually always been this way. The reality is that it's been masked really well through some of those those PR things that they're very good at, whether it's international order or mobilizing people around something. They've masked it pretty well. Trump's just his, I go back to it, I think his like honesty is a blessing for the rest of the world. His open honesty about what they do and what they want is open. I actually go back to something earlier. 2018, he did a famous Super Bowl interview. And a president always does one on Super Bowl day because the whole country watches it, right?
Right.
So it's a great opportunity for the president to say what they want to say. He famously was questioned about Putin back then and like how he's barbaric. And Trump said openly, like, we're not the good guys. We go around killing people in the world. So what?
Yes.
And people don't take that stuff seriously. That's, you know, like, ha ha, you know, he's just being funny. But he's not. He's honest about who America is. And this is, and look, we've had a Biden term in the middle and an Obama term before. Obama famously bombed a Yemeni wedding. And we're talking about Trump's strikes in Yemen.
Yeah.
But like, he killed tons of civilians. The biggest drone program in escalation was under Obama. He killed more people then than even Biden or Trump since with the drone program. So presidents have continued this path. All I, what I, going back to the European aspect of this, what more do you need to see? Like, what European leaders, you've been taken for fools. And you are, like, maybe you are fools. You're letting your publics down because he didn't lie about what he wanted to do with Ukraine. And also, by the way, Biden signed the first business deal with Ukraine. This is American foreign policy. What can we get out of it?
Yes.
Right? They got, American companies lined up for mineral rights deals with Ukraine for American funding of arms to continue.
Yeah.
Joe Biden organized that. Anthony Blinken organized that.
Yes.
Not Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump's escalating it. And the reason there isn't a peace deal right now is they're negotiating directly with Putin about who gets what out of Ukraine. And Europe, you can keep pretending you're going to send troops because no one believes you, because no European citizen is going to go fight for Ukrainians.
Correct.
No one's going to go pick up guns against the Russian army. Mm-hmm. No one's going to do that. So European, with their posturing, with their press conferences, where they put their suits on and whatever the hell they're doing, right? Yeah. It's just posturing. And are we going to continue to send money to a war that, by the way, is over by all by any stretch of the imagination? The Americans and Russians will settle this. Ukraine will sign this. And the reality is, like most people America have backed, that they've decided to turn their back on. We've seen this in history from Chile to like Vietnam and everything else. Those leaders end up disappearing. And I'm sorry, Zelensky will probably go away somewhere. Maybe to Switzerland, maybe something else. Who knows?
Who knows? I hear Epstein's island's free.
But the reality is that Europe has no say in how that sells.
Mm.
Now, when he talks about other things, Europe will not have us. Did Starmer, Macron know that they were going to call Hamas up and talk to them directly and suddenly go on CNN and said they were not that bad to talk to directly? They're like, just like us.
So let's talk about that briefly, because my understanding is that even members, senior members of the US administration were unaware that those backdoor negotiations with Hamas were going to happen.
Yep.
And when it was leaked, that's when we suddenly got the, you know, if you remember the Mahmoud Khalil posters, you know, deport him now, and all kinds of other, you know, shock and awe tactics designed to kind of reinforce and I think probably reassure the Israelis that these backdoor negotiations weren't sort of a betrayal, which is obviously 100%. How they were being painted internally.
But I go back to the foreign policy elements. Europe, you're not in the room.
Yes.
They will eventually get a deal with Hamas. Okay. I believe
you think there'll be a direct deal between the US and Hamas.
Yes, and it will involve Qatar probably and everything. But I don't see Starmer in the room. I don't see Macron in the room. They might even have a deal where these guys get to go. Like, that works maybe. I don't believe they're any friend to Palestinians. Let's just get that true. Let's get that out there. But there might be a deal that gives them some power. How are European leaders going to feel about that when they keep saying they can't be in power ever again? Like, it doesn't matter what you think, actually.
Yes.
They're talking to Iran. They're about to go start to talk to Iran, and they might have direct talks immediately. They might skip the whole like channel of like indirect talks.
Yeah.
Europe didn't know about that. Again, Macron's not in the room. Starmer's not in the room. They might have a nuclear deal without Europe.
Yeah.
Like, Europe doesn't have a say, is irrelevant in this discussion. Mm. And what on a more micro level, European leaders are still so desperate to have a good relationship with them without being multipolar and connecting with other organizations or countries in the world.
Emerging powers.
That even the British government is abandoning British citizens who've been arrested by ICE so they can get a better trade tariff. Peter Mandelson's embassy in Washington, D.C. has let Brits get arrested. And instead of fighting for them, like other countries have been fighting for their citizens who've been arrested, Colombia asking for a fair deportation, they sent the jet. so they could get their people not in handcuffs. They're fighting for their people. Brits have been in prison cells, in ICE detention cells, which anyone knows anything about this? These are basically torture cells. People have been forced to hose shower. A British citizen recently wrote about her experience, and she's a white woman from the North. You know, they're not just arresting brown and black people. So if you're a Brit going to America this summer, and this will be continuing, by the way, if you are arrested by ICE, don't expect Peter Mandelson to come for you. Mm-hmm. Don't expect Keir Starmer to come for you, because they're desperately trying to cling on some special relationship that does not exist. Because if it did, British people would be treated a bit better in the United States. And that's part of the problem. Yeah. We're holding on to something that existed a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like we've always been the junior partner in that.
Yes.
But now is non-existent, and we're still clamoring onto something
right. That
has no purpose for us.
I mean, definitely as someone who lives in Britain, it feels to me like Britain is still holding on to a perception of itself as having a much greater relevance mm-hmm. on the world stage than I think is reflected by mm-hmm. the reality of what we're observing. Mm-hmm. That today, you know, the UK, especially separate from Europe, is a small backwater mm-hmm. with, you know, a dwindling economy
yep.
and a huge brain drain. You 100%. Know, this country is in free fall at yes. the moment. And there's no real recognition of that, because there's just this desperation that somehow if we continue to cling on to American coattails, mm-hmm. that we will recover.
Yeah.
And I don't think that there are any promises, at least from what we're seeing from the Trump administration, mm-hmm. no. that there are any overtures being made that suggest no. that we will be included in whatever, you know, end game we're meant to see here. And the only end game I'm currently seeing is the US economy tanking hard, yeah. right? So I don't know what this is, who we're expecting to yeah, follow
but
down.
Also just like on that point, lane. Like everything he's doing is deliberate by design. People think sure. it's like he doesn't know what he's doing. Still, we're in this mindset of like Trump doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah.
Everything, the people around, it's by design.
Yeah.
Bannon's whole plan when they took office is shock and awe. Yes. The executive orders are by design distracting media. Oh, mm. he's doing this, he's doing that.
Right.
But under the surface, they know what they're doing, right? They're like every fascist regime, they're going after the public, the courts, the politicians.
Education.
And the government departments, right? So guess what? Politicians folded. Democrats, Hakeem Jeffrey, the leader of the Democrat Party, basically said, we can't do anything. Yeah. You know, Mitch McConnell, who is the devil, was the Republican leader under Obama, had no Senate, no House, and still said openly on day one, I want to make him a one-term president. And while he had no real say in anything, he just got in the way.
Right.
Hakeem Jeffries isn't even attempting to get in the way. The poster child to the left, AOC, is doing nothing about it. And I just want to say that this is important part. Like, the courts are half theirs.
Yes.
And also they've already shown that they're not going to listen to rulings against them.
Yes.
Because guess what? The courts don't have any enforcement power because the executive controls enforcement.
Well, and they've made that very clear.
Very clear. And then the third thing is like the government departments. After Trump's first term, they were hollowed out a bit. And the government departments, actually, people don't know, a lot of people in the government fought back on his changes.
Mm.
And a lot of those civil servants are not there anymore. Mm. And Biden didn't refill the civil service in his 4 years. Obviously, the pandemic impacted the first two of those.
Yeah.
So, like, he didn't, like, refill the shop.
Yes.
So hollowing out the civil service and getting rid of government departments has never been easier in the United States. And finally, he's leaving it to the public.
Yeah.
And the one thing he knows, and this touches on your green card thing with Mahmoud Khalil, they want Khalil to go to court.
Yes.
And the reason this is so important to them is because it sets up a fight on citizenship. And I'll tell everyone why quickly. American governments, like any government, can take away visas. Like, you know, yes. any government has the right to take away visas, for whatever reasons. The green card to people is like, you're basically an American citizen.
Well, that's
like,
what I always thought.
It's golden.
Thought.
You've got that. Yeah. You're on your way. Like, you're okay. The only thing you can't do is vote and get Social Security. Right? So it's super protected. You need a court order to remove it.
Yeah.
So the reason they're going after this so hard, and a Palestinian, yes, it is to maybe reinforce their loyalty to Israel, their relationship with Israel. But actually, it's really tactical, because they believe the left and the center left will not back him. Like if this was a Latino guy or yes. a black guy from Jamaica who's getting his green card, maybe AOC and Hakeem Jeffries will speak up, and it will turn into a political football until the court date. But have you noticed that no Democrat leader, including the poster child of the left, is saying anything in defense of Mahmoud Khalil? And they're using everyone's myopic prejudice,
yes,
not wanting to speak about Palestine, as the way to make this happen and get a ruling in their favor. And the reason they're doing this is they want to use the national security argument to go after citizenship. Mm. And the first step after the green card, if they get the ruling they want, is naturalized citizens. So if you're an American who emigrated there and became a citizen, that's not protected under the Constitution. Birthright is. They will use the same ruling to go after the 30 million Americans who are naturalized. Mm. That is going to set precedent to hollow the country out for the people they want to stay in the country.
Got it.
And they can use national security because you don't have to delve what the national security incident is publicly every time. And
because of terrorism laws.
You know where they got this idea from? The UK. Because of the Begum case.
So Shamima Begum, a young girl who was a teenager, was basically trafficked by, for all intents and purposes, Canadian Secret Services into ISIS-held territory at the time. And she ends up becoming a teen mom, loses all her children, is then detained in a camp. And despite being a dual national British Bengali, she'd never been to Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. And the British government strips her of her British identity. The Bengali government says, well, we're not going to take her because she's never been here and she's not Bengali. And so she basically ends up stateless in still today in northeastern Syria in a camp that's controlled by a
Kurdish. And you can thank the British government's like lack of morals for this charade that you're seeing in the United States. Not charade, but like policy that you're seeing in the United States.
Yeah.
And the eventual goal is to go after birthright. Not enough people are talking about this.
Yeah.
And the reason that not enough people are talking about it, they're prejudiced against Palestinians. They can't see the path from this green card to birthright.
Yeah.
Marco Rubio has already set out that naturalized citizens aren't protected.
He's already saying
the State Department go, can you apply this to naturalized citizens? They're like, we're not going to deny that. Like, they've literally gone and done it. They're not even hiding what
they're
I'm telling you.
They're not even hiding where we're heading.
And we're still seeing the left and the center left not want to talk about Palestine.
So this is what Noura Erekat, Professor Noura Erekat, talks about as Palestinians being the canaries in the coal mine, right? So Palestinians are being used to 100%. Set legal precedents that impact the wider civil liberties of all citizens, and yet ingrained prejudice, which has been, you know, worked deep into us for years, generations, is impeding our ability to recognize that kind of, regardless of who this is happening to, it's an assault on all of our freedoms.
100%.
So just on that point, before I want to hear about the case that you are leading against Biden, but before we get to that, so is there a sense for you that today in America, that what gets called the pro-Palestine movement, I have my reservations about the term because I think that the movement is really about equality, freedom, justice. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's like pro-Palestine, it makes it sound like it's a football team and it's really not. But anyway, we'll call it that. So is there a sense today that the sort of pro-Palestine movement has actually merged with an almost existential fight against increasingly overt fascists? So that actually today, when people are marching for Palestine, they're actually marching for something much wider than that. I mean, is that your sense today? And can you just explain that?
And there's a difference between that and the marches you saw over the past week and the hands-off marches.
Tell us what the mood's been
like. So Palestinians have always fought for everyone. And themselves will always say, I remember at the beginning of this when... look, this genocide is the issue of our time. You can't fight fascism if you're failing to address the most fascist crime that can be committed. Because anyone not talking about the genocide is not really fighting fascism because it's our foreign policy. So you can't fight that and not talk about that and then say you're fighting Trump at home or
hashtag
fighting Starmer.
All lives matter.
Yeah, hashtag all lives matter. It's a very appropriate term. But the Palestinians have always fought for everyone. I remember at the beginning of this when in the United States a Palestinian kid was stabbed in Chicago.
Yeah, a six-year-old boy, I think it was, right?
Palestinians from Gaza who are being shelled, reaching out to that family, right? Not because they're Palestinian, because the kid was stabbed.
Yeah.
Right? I, unfortunately, have had an incident where an Israeli woman attacked my son in a playground.
Right.
Because I wore a keffiyeh.
Yeah.
1 month after the genocide started.
Yeah.
She tried to burn my son with a hot beverage and threw a phone at him.
Unbelievable. In New York.
In a playground. And Palestinians from Gaza and the West Bank reached out to me. Think about that.
Yes.
They're under siege.
Yes.
They're being massacred, yet people from there in Palestine found the time and energy and showed their affection and love. And this has been reported multiple times where people have had incidents in the United States or UK where they've been attacked, where people from Palestine have sent their love.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, I can't get half the country, more than half of it sometimes, to even engage in talking about a genocide that's happening to that same race of people. So all that to say is that, like, if we're not going to talk about this genocide, we're not fighting fascism.
Right.
And those marches that happened in the United States, while great that, like, a whole bunch of people turned out this last weekend to say hands off our community, hands off our rights, hands off this, a lot of those people, those marchers, were told they can't carry Palestinian signs.
Mm.
And that should speak to what those marches are. My favorite, not so favorite sign was, if Kamala won, we'd still be at brunch. That basically is where American liberals are.
Wow. Right? I mean, that tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah, so we'll continue the genocide. We'll be at brunch.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of where they want to be.
Yes.
The reason Trump annoys them, while he annoys foreign leaders for other reasons, is he holds up America to who Americans are.
Yes.
And a lot of white Americans by that extent, like, of white liberal Americans, and anyone else who's bought the Kool-Aid into the American capitalist thing. Like, they're basically, that's who they are. We don't really care about anybody else.
You don't want to see your brunch eggs drenched in Palestinian kids' blood. No. You just want brunch. No. And the blood, can we have that as a side?
Yes. And that's basically where they're at. I mean, the fact that they're still holding up those signs like she was going to be better for them and better for the United States is insane. And to give them context, if they think it's going to be better for them, the reason we're at this point where Marco Rubio and Donald Trump can strip green cards is because Antony Blinken laid the groundwork for that.
Mm.
He was already looking. He was already, a lot of Palestinians can speak to this better than me, they were already revoking student visas for Arab and Palestinian citizens who partake in the student encampments in the summer in 2024, because the election hadn't happened until November, so Trump wasn't in office. So a lot of people who couldn't go back to many universities in the United States who were appealing their decisions. And the reason we didn't hear about it is lawyers were advising them not to create a media storm around it so they can maybe get there.
Well, we saw it here too, right? Yeah. There was this Palestinian student here who was stripped of her visa for using the word resistance
It's wild.
A protest.
Like, so that was already happening. And Blinken was looking into stripping green cards for Palestinians.
Mm.
So the groundwork was laid for Marco Rubio and Donald Trump to do this by Democrats. So if Democrats think this is going to get better, no chance.
So what I'm hearing from you, which is something that I feel like I'm hearing a lot on social media and from friends, is in general that the idea that we have a system that offers genuine choice between candidates that offer differential programs and visions for the future has been completely eroded.
Yeah.
That actually most of us are now waking up to the reality that these political leaders, while some small variants in terms of domestic policies overall, it seems that they have been completely co-opted by private interests. Yeah. And that in that sense, the very notion of us living in a democratic system of, you know, people power, power by the people for the people is illusionary, right? Completely illusionary. The Tea is a fully independent, nonpartisan production. No corporate ties here, just a small, dedicated team working hard to bring you honest, impactful conversations. If you believe in our work, please subscribe to our YouTube channel. Just click on that subscribe button now and join us as a Patreon. You'll find the link in our bio. Can you tell us a little bit, obviously, you're now revealing, you know, here on The Tea.
So that was a very enlightening interview that was done by this new show, The Tea, which included everything. The reason why I wanted to share this, it included everything we've been talking about on this show since the beginning of this genocide and before it. For one, is that how there's a continuation, how what Biden did, he basically paved the way for this fascist to carry on. He paved the road that Trump is traveling on right now. Everything that he left on the table is being carried through by Trump. But one of the most important things that they mentioned, and I mentioned at the top of the hour, is that this Mahmoud Khalil case is more important than people think, as important as it is, because it is the canary in the coal mine. They're testing this out so that they can expand this, not just for green card holders, but for citizens. And they haven't been shy about it. They have actually said that we're testing right now, we're looking into how we do this for citizens and even for people who were born here, citizens who were born here. And basically, they want to go to court, and they're hoping to win so that they can set a legal precedent to expand this from Palestinians to immigrants at large, which they're already doing, to Americans and even Americans born here that disagree with them or resist them or say something that they don't like, or take legal action against them. And we've learned also that Harvard University, like from the, if you listen to Democracy Now!, which you should be listening to every morning, you should start your morning to figure out if the world you know is still out there. If you listened, she had a speaker on from Harvard University that is part of the coalition of professors that have come together to resist what's going on, talking about exactly this and about how even we have these outfits that are being threatened that if they pick up a case against the Trump administration, that there will be retaliation. That's one of those. That's some of the most important things that were mentioned there. We'll continue this conversation next Wednesday at 2 p.m. Thank you for listening. This is Zain Lamine with the Shayanana Show, signing out.
Chris Williams with the WPFW editorial. Kilmar Abrego Garcia, an apprentice sheet metal worker raising three children with his wife in Prince George's County, has been kidnapped by the United States government. On March 12th, Abrego Garcia was pulled over by ICE agents, accused of being a member of the Salvadoran gang MS-13, and then transported to a terrorist confinement center in his native El Salvador. In fact, Abrego Garcia had fled his homeland at 16 because of threats from local gangs, and a U.S. immigration judge in 2019 granted him protection from being deported because he would face persecution if he ever returned. The Justice Department admitted that his removal was an administrative error, and the U.S. Supreme Court ordered the government to facilitate the return of Abrego Garcia, who has never been charged with a crime or found to have any gang affiliation. President Trump shrugged and said that it was up to El Salvador. Salvadoran dictator Nayib Bukele, appearing in the Oval Office, scoffed that the idea of releasing him was, quote, preposterous, while Trump and top advisors smiled approvingly. This is an appalling violation of law and of justice that must not be allowed to stand. If Kilmar Abrego Garcia can be disappeared in this way, none of us is safe. This is Dennis Williams with a WPFW editorial.
Reparations Valley, Saturday, May 17th, a festival of unity in celebration of the ongoing quest for reparations, as well as the 100th anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X. Speakers include Michael Eric Dyson, Robin Ruth Simmons, O'Malley Yeshitela, Ajua Ayatoro, with virtual remarks from Marilana Karenga, actress Erica Alexander, and Ben Chavis. Performance include the rapper Vasquez, along with DC's own Ayanna Gregory, Afi Soul, Lucy Murphy, Nana Malaya and the Malcolm X dancers and drummers, Free Benjamin, Randy Payton, and Laini Mataka. May 17th, Landsberg Park, 1098 Delaware Avenue Southwest, 11 a.m.
How we gonna make reparations rise? Agitate, educate, organize. How we gonna make reparations rise? Agitate, educate.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration on Friday, April 25th from 7 until 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt, Maryland. Entertainment will be provided by vocalist Navasha Dea and her trio, and WPFW programmers and poets Esther Averam and Zain El Amin. The evening includes an award ceremony, dinner,